but that won't be in my time. Now it's work hard all the time or be a bum. No in between. When I die, nobody will remember me for long. No one will say, he was a man who loved his family and believed in the Union. All they will say is, too bad, but he was nothing but a drunk, no matter which way you look at it. Yes, they'll say that. The room was very quiet. Johnny Nolan threw his half-smoked cigar out of the unscreened window with a bitter gesture. He had a premonition that he was running his life out too fast. He looked at the little girl ironing away so quietly with her head bent over the board, and he was stabbed by the soft sadness on the child's thin face. Listen. He went to her and put an arm around her thin shoulders. If I get a lot of tips tonight, I'll put the money on a good horse that I know is running Monday. I'll put a couple of dollars on him and win 10. Then I'll put the 10 on another horse I know and win 100. If I use my head and have any kind of luck at all, I'll run it up to 500. Pipe dreams, he thought to himself, even while he was telling her about his dream winnings. But oh, how wonderful, he thought, if everything you talked about could come true. He went on talking. Then do you know what I'm going to do, prima donna? Francie smiled happily, pleased at his using the nickname he had given her when, as a baby, he swore that her crying was as varied and as tuneful as an opera singer's range. No, what are you going to do? I'm going to take you on a trip. Just you and me, prima donna. We'll go way down south where the cotton blossoms blow. He was delighted with the sentence. He said it again. Down where the cotton blossoms blow. Then he remembered that the sentence was a line in a song that he knew. He jammed his hands in his pockets, whistled, and started to do a waltz clog like Pat Rooney. Then he went into the song. A field of snowy white, hear the darkies singing soft and low. I long there to be, for someone waits for me, down where the cotton blossoms blow. Francie kissed his cheek softly. Oh, Papa, I love you so much. She whispered. He held her tight. Again the stab wound feeling. Oh, God, oh, God! He repeated to himself in almost unendurable agony. What a hell of a father I am! But when he spoke to her again, it was quietly enough. Well, this isn't getting my apron ironed, though. It's all done, Papa. She folded it into a careful square. Is there any money in the house, baby? She looked into the cracked cup on the shelf. A nickel and some pennies? Would you take 7 cents and go out and get me a dickie and a paper collar? Francie went over to the dry goods store to get her father's Saturday night linen. A dickie was a shirt front made of stiffly starched muslin. It fastened around the neck with a collar button and the vest held it in place. It was used instead of a shirt. It was worn once and then thrown away. A paper collar was not exactly made out of paper. It was called that to differentiate it from a celluloid collar, which was what poor men wore because it could be laundered simply by being wiped with a wet rag. A paper collar was made out of thin cambric stiffly starched. It could be used only once. When Francie got back, Papa had shaved, wetted his hair down, shined his shoes, and put on a clean undershirt. It was unironed and had a big hole in the back, but it smelled nice and clean. He stood on a chair and took down a little box from the top cupboard shelf. It contained the pearl studs that Katie had given him for a wedding present. They had cost her a month's salary. Johnny was very proud of them. No matter how hard up the Nolans were, the studs were never pawned. Francie helped him put the studs in the dickie. He fastened the wing collar on with a golden collar button, a present that Hildy O'Dare had given him before he became engaged to Katie. He wouldn't part with that either. His tie was a piece of heavy black silk, and he tied an expert bow with it. Other waiters wore ready-made bows attached to elastics, but not Johnny Nolan. Other waiters wore soiled white shirts or clean shirts indifferently ironed in celluloid collars, but not Johnny. His linen was immaculate, if temporary. He was dressed at last. His wavy blonde hair gleamed, and he smelled clean and fresh from washing and shaving. He put his coat on and buttoned it up jauntily. The satin lapels of the tuxedo were threadbare, but who would look at that when the suit fitted him so beautifully and the crease in his trousers was so perfect? Francie looked at his well-polished black shoes and noticed how the cuffless trousers came down in the back over the heel and what a nice break they made across his instep. No other father's pants hung just that way. Francie was proud of her father. She wrapped up his ironed apron carefully in a piece of clean paper saved for that purpose. She walked with him to the trolley car. Women smiled at him until they noticed the little girl clinging to his hand. Johnny looked like a handsome, devil-may-care Irish boy, instead of the husband of a scrubwoman and the father of two children who were always hungry. They passed Gabriel's hardware store and stopped to look at the skates in the window. Mama never had time to do this. Papa talked as though he would buy Francie a pair some day. They walked to the corner. When a Graham Avenue trolley came along, he swung up onto the platform, suiting his rhythm to the car slowing down. As the car started up again, he stood on the back platform holding on to the bar while he leaned way out to wave to Francie. No man had ever looked so gallant as her father, she thought. After she had seen Papa off, Francie went up to see what kind of costume Floss Gladys had for the dance that night. Flossie supported her mother and brother by working as a turner in a kid glove factory. The gloves were stitched on the wrong side, and it was her job to turn them right side out. Often she brought work home to do at night. They needed every cent they could get on account of her brother not being able to work. He had consumption. Francie had been told that Henny Gaddis was dying, but she didn't believe it. He didn't look it. In fact, he looked wonderful. He had clear skin with a beautiful pink color in his cheeks. His eyes were large and dark and burned steadily like a lamp protected from the wind. But he knew. He was 19 and avid for life, and he couldn't understand why he was doomed. Mrs. Gaddis was glad to see Francie. Company took Henny's thoughts off himself. "Henny, here's Francie," she called out cheerfully. "Hello, Francie." "Hello, Henny." "Don't you think Henny's looking good, Francie? Tell him that he's looking good." "You're looking good, Henny." Henny addressed an unseen companion. "She tells a dying man that he's looking good."
"I mean it."
"No, you don't. You're just saying that."
"How you talk, Henny. Look at me. How skinny I am, and I never think about dying."
"You won't die, Francie. You were born to lick this rotten life."
"Still and all, I wish I had nice red cheeks like you."
"No, you don't. Not if you know where they come from."
"Henny, you should sit on the roof more," said his mother.
"She tells a dying man he should sit on the roof," reported Henny to his invisible companion. "Fresh air is what you need, and sunshine. Leave me alone, Mama."
"For your own good.
Mama, Mama, leave me alone. Leave me alone." Suddenly he put his head down on his arms and pulled tormented coughing sobs out of his body. Flossie and her mother looked at each other and silently agreed to let him alone. They left him coughing and sobbing in the kitchen and went into the front room to show Francie the costumes. Flossie did three things each week. She worked on the gloves, she worked on her costumes, and she worked on Frank. She went to a masquerade ball every Saturday night, wearing a different costume each time. The costumes were especially designed to hide her disfigured right arm. As a child, she had fallen into a wash boiler of scalding hot water carelessly left standing on the kitchen floor. Her right arm had been horribly burned, and she grew up with its skin withered and purple. She always wore long sleeves. Since it was essential that a masquerade costume be décolleté, she had devised a backless costume, the front cut to display her over-full bust, and with one long sleeve to cover that right arm. The judges thought that one flowing sleeve symbolized something. Invariably, she won first prize. Flossie got into the costume she was going to wear that night. It resembled the popular conception of what a Klondike dance hall girl wore. It was made of a purple satin sheath with layers of cerise tarleton underskirts. There was a black sequin butterfly stitched over the place where her left breast came to a blunt point. The one sleeve was made of pea-green chiffon. Francie admired the costume. Flossie's mother threw open the closet door, and Francie looked at the row of brilliantly colored garments. Flossie had six sheaths of various colors, and the same number of tarleton underskirts, and at least 20 chiffon sleeves of every color that a person could imagine. Each week, Flossie switched the combinations to make a new costume. Next week, the cerise underskirt might froth out from beneath a sky blue sheath with one black chiffon sleeve, and so on. There were 2 dozen tightly rolled, never-used silk umbrellas in that closet, prizes she had won. Flossie collected them for display the way an athlete collects cups. Francie felt happy looking at all the umbrellas. Poor people have a great passion for huge quantities of things. While Francie was admiring the costumes, she began to grow uneasy. While looking at the brilliant frothing colors, cerise, orange, bright blue, red, and yellow, she had a feeling that something was stealthily concealed behind those costumes. It was something wrapped in a long, somber cloak with a grinning skull and bones for hands. And it was hiding behind these brilliant colors, waiting for Henny. Mama came home at 6 with Aunt Sissy. Francie was very glad to see Sissy. She was her favorite aunt. Francie loved her and was fascinated by her. So far, Sissy had led a very exciting life. She was 35 now, had been married 3 times, and had given birth to 10 children, all of whom had died soon after being born. Sissy often said that Francie was all of her 10 children. Sissy worked in a rubber factory and was very wild as far as men were concerned. She had roving black eyes, black curling hair, and a high clear color. She liked to wear a cherry-colored bow in her hair. Mama was wearing her jade-green hat, which made her skin look like cream off the top of the bottle. The roughness of her pretty hands was hidden by a pair of white cotton gloves. She and Sissy came in talking excitedly and laughing as they recalled to each other the jokes they had heard at the show. Sissy brought Francie a present, a corncob pipe that you blew into, and a rubber hand popped up and swelled over the pipe bowl. The pipe came from Sissy's factory. The factory made a few rubber toys as a blind. It made its big profits from other rubber articles, which were bought in whispers. Francie hoped that Sissy would stay for supper. When Sissy was around, everything was gay and glamorous. Francie felt that Sissy understood how it was with little girls. Other people treated children like lovable but necessary evils. Sissy treated them like important human beings. But although Mama urged her, Sissy wouldn't stay. She had to go home, she said, and see if her husband still loved her. This made Mama laugh. Francie laughed, too, although she didn't understand what Sissy meant. Sissy left after promising that she would come back on the 1st of the month with the magazines. Sissy's current husband worked for a pulp magazine house. Each month he received copies of all their publications. Love stories, Wild West stories, detective stories, supernatural stories, and whatnot. They had shiny, colorful covers, and he received them from the stockroom tied up in a length of new yellow twine. Sissy brought them over to Francie just as they came. Francie read them all avidly, then sold them at half price to the neighborhood stationery store and put the money in Mama's tin can bank. After Sissy left, Francie told Mama about the old man at Loescher's with the obscene feet. "Nonsense," said Mama. "Old age isn't such a tragedy. If he was the only old man in the world, yes, but he has other old men to keep him company. Old people are not unhappy. They don't long for the things we want. They just want to be warm and have soft food to eat and remember things with each other. Stop being so foolish. If there's one thing certain, it's that we all have to get old someday. So get used to the idea as quickly as you can." Francie knew that Mama was right. Still, she was glad when Mama spoke of something else. She and Mama planned what meals they'd make from the stale bread in the week to come. The Nolans practically lived on that stale bread, and what amazing things Katie could make from it. She'd take a loaf of stale bread, pour boiling water over it, work it up into a paste, flavor it with salt, pepper, thyme, minced onion, and an egg, if eggs were cheap, and bake it in the oven. When it was good and brown, she made a sauce from 1/2 cup of ketchup, 2 cups of boiling water, seasoning, a dash of strong coffee, thickened it with flour, and poured it over the baked stuff. It was good, hot, tasty, and staying. What was left over was sliced thin the next day and fried in hot bacon fat. Mama made a very fine bread pudding from slices of stale bread, sugar, cinnamon, and a penny apple sliced thin. When this was baked brown, sugar was melted and poured over the top. Sometimes she made what she had named Weg Geschnissen, which laboriously translated meant something made with bread bits that usually would be thrown away. Bits of bread were dipped into a batter made from flour, water, salt, and an egg, and then fried in deep hot fat. While they were frying, Francie ran down to the candy store and bought a penny's worth of brown rock candy. This was crushed with a rolling pin and sprinkled on top of the fried bits just before eating. The crystals didn't quite melt, and that made it wonderful. Saturday supper was a red-letter meal. The Nolans had fried meat. A loaf of stale bread was made into pulp with hot water and mixed with a dime's worth of chopped meat into which an onion had been cleavered. Salt and a penny's worth of minced parsley were added for flavor. This was made up into little balls, fried and served with hot ketchup. These meatballs had a name, fricadellin, which was a great joke with Francie and Neely. They lived mostly on these things made from stale bread and condensed milk and coffee, onions, potatoes, and always the penny's worth of something bought at the last minute, added for Philip. Once in a while, they had a banana, but Francie always longed for oranges and pineapple, and especially tangerines, which she got only at Christmas. Sometimes, when she had a spare penny, she bought broken crackers. The grocery man would make a toot, which was a poke made of a bit of twisted paper, and fill it with bits of sweet crackers that had been broken in the box and could no longer be sold as whole crackers. Mama's rule was, don't buy candy or cake if you have a penny. Buy an apple. But what was an apple? Francie found that a raw potato tasted just as good, and this she could have for free. There were times, though, especially towards the end of a long, cold, dark winter, when no matter how hungry Francie was, nothing tasted good. That was big pickle time. She'd take a penny and go down to a store on Moore Street that had nothing in it but fat Jew pickles floating around in a heavy, spiced brine. A patriarch with a long white beard, black skullcap, and toothless gums presided over the vats with a big forked wooden stick. Francie ordered the same as the other kids did. "Give me a penny sheeny pickle." The Hebrew looked at the Irish child with his fierce red-rimmed eyes, small, tortured, and fiery. "Goyim, goyim," he spat at her, hating the word sheeny. Francie meant no harm. She didn't know what the word meant, really. It was a term applied to something alien, yet beloved. The Jew, of course, did not know this. Francie had been told that he had one vat from which he sold only to Gentiles. It was said that he spat or did worse in this vat once a day. That was his revenge. But this was never proven against the poor old Jew, and Francie, for one, did not believe it. As he stirred with his stick, muttering curses into his stained white beard, he was thrown into a hysterical passion by Francie asking for a pickle from the bottom of the vat. This brought on eye-rollings and clutchings of the beard. Eventually, a fine, fat pickle, greenish-yellow and hard at the ends, was fished out and laid on a scrap of brown paper. Still cursing, the Jew received her penny in his vinegar-scarred palm and retired to the rear of his store, where his temper cooled as he sat nodding in his beard, dreaming of old days in the old country. The pickle lasted all day. Francie sucked and nibbled on it. She didn't exactly eat it. She just had it. When they had just bread and potatoes too many times at home, Francie's thoughts went to dripping sour pickles. She didn't know why, but after a day of the pickle, the bread and potatoes tasted good again. Yes, pickle day was something to look forward to. Neely came home, and he and Francie were sent out for the weekend meet. This was an important ritual and called for detailed instructions by Mama. Get a 5-cent soup bone off at Hassler's, but don't get the chopped meat there. Go to Werner's for that. Get round steak, chopped, 10 cents worth, and don't let him give it to you off the plate. Take an onion with you, too. Francie and her brother stood at the counter a long time before the butcher noticed them. "What's yours?" he asked finally. Francie started the negotiations.
10 cents worth of round steak.
Ground?
No.
Lady was just then. Bought a quarter's worth of round steak ground. Only I ground too much, and here's the rest on the plate. Just 10 cents worth. Honestly, I only just ground it.
This was the pitfall Francie had been told to watch against. Don't buy it off the plate, no matter what the butcher says.
No, my mother said 10 cents worth of round steak.
Furiously, the butcher hacked off a bit of meat and slammed it down on the paper after weighing it. He was just about to wrap it up when Francie said in a trembling voice,
"Oh, I forgot. My mother wants it ground."
"God damn it to hell!"
He hacked up the meat and shoved it into the chopper. Tricked again, he thought bitterly. The meat came out in fresh red spirals. He gathered it up in his hand and was just about to slam it down on the paper when,
"And Mama said to chop up this onion in it."
Timidly, she pushed the peeled onion that she had brought from home across the counter. Neely stood by and said nothing. His function was to come along for moral support.
"Jesus!" the butcher said explosively, but he went to work with two cleavers chopping the onion up into the meat. Francie watched, loving the drumbeat rhythm of the cleavers. Again the butcher gathered up the meat, slammed it down on the paper, and glared at Francie. She gulped. The last order would be hardest of all. The butcher had an idea of what was coming. He stood there trembling inwardly. Francie said all on one breath.
And a piece of suet to fry it with.
Son of a bitchin' bastard, whispered the butcher bitterly. He slashed off a piece of white fat, let it fall to the floor in revenge, picked it up and slammed it on the mound of meat. He wrapped it furiously, snatched the dime, and as he turned over to the boss for ringing up, he cursed the destiny that had made him a butcher. After the chopped meat deal, they went to Hassler's for the soup bone. Hassler was a fine butcher for bones, but a bad butcher for chopped meat, because he ground it behind closed doors and God knows what you got. Neely waited outside with a package, because if Hassler noticed you had bought meat elsewhere, he'd proudly tell you to go get your bone where you got your other meat. Francie ordered a nice bone with some meat on it for Sunday soup for 5 cents. Hassler made her wait while he told the stale joke, how a man had bought 2 cents worth of dog meat, and how Hassler had asked, should he wrap it up or do you want to eat it here? Francie smiled shyly. The pleased butcher went into the icebox and returned holding up a gleaming white bone with creamy marrow in it and shreds of red meat clinging to the ends. He made Francie admire it. After your mama cooks this, he said, tell her to take the marrow out, spread it on a piece of bread with pepper salt, and make a nice sandwich for you. I'll tell mama. You eat it and get some meat on your bones. After the bone was wrapped and paid for, he sliced off a thick piece of liverwurst and gave it to her. Francie was sorry that she deceived that kind man by buying the other meat elsewhere. Too bad Mama didn't trust him about chopped meat. It was still early in the evening, and the street lights had not yet come on. But already the horseradish lady was sitting in front of Hassler's grinding away at her pungent roots. Francie held out the cup that she had brought from home. The old mother filled it halfway up for 2 cents. Happy that the meat business was over, Francie bought 2 cents worth of soup greens from the greengrocer's. She got an emasculated carrot, a droopy leaf of celery, a soft tomato, and a fresh sprig of parsley. These would be boiled with a bone to make a rich soup with shreds of meat floating in it. Fat homemade noodles would be added. This, with a seasoned marrow spread on bread, would make a good Sunday dinner. After a supper of fried fricadellin, potatoes, smashed pie, and coffee, Neely went down on the street to play with his friends. Although there was no signal nor agreement, the boys always gathered on the corner after supper, where they stood the whole evening, hands in pockets, shoulders hunched forward, arguing, laughing, pushing each other around, and jigging in time to whistled tunes. Maudie Donovan came around to go to confession with Francie. Maudie was an orphan who lived with two maiden aunts who worked at home. They made ladies' shrouds for a living at so much per dozen for a casket company. They made satin-tufted shrouds, white ones for dead virgins, pale lavender for the young married, purple for the middle-aged, and black for the old. Maudie brought some pieces. She thought Francie might like to make something out of them. Francie pretended to be glad but shuddered as she put the gleaming scraps away. The church was smoky with incense and guttering candles. The nuns had put fresh flowers on the altars. The Blessed Mother's altar had the nicest flowers. She was more popular with the sisters than either Jesus or Joseph. People were lined up outside the confessionals. The girls and fellows wanted to get it over with before they went out on their dates. The line was longest at Father O'Flynn's cubicle. He was young, kind, tolerant, and easy on the penances. When her turn came, Francie pushed aside the heavy curtain and knelt in the confessional. The old, old mystery took hold as the priest slid open the tiny door that separated him from the sinner and made the sign of the cross before the grilled window. He started whispering rapidly and monotonously in Latin with his eyes closed. She caught the mingled odors of incense, candle wax, flowers, and the good black cloth and shaving lotion of the priest. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Quickly were her sins confessed and quickly absolved. She came out with her head bowed over her clasped hands. She genuflected before the altar, then knelt at the rail. She said her penance using her mother-of-pearl rosary to keep count of the prayers. Maudie, who lived a less complicated life, had had fewer sins to confess and had gotten out sooner. She was sitting outside on the steps waiting when Francie came out. They walked up and down the block, arms about each other's waists, the way girlfriends did in Brooklyn. Maudie had a penny.
She bought an ice cream sandwich and treated Francie to a bite. Soon Maudie had to go in. She wasn't allowed out on the street after 8 at night. The girls parted after mutual promises were asked and given to go to confession together the following Saturday.
"Don't forget," called Maudie, walking backwards away from Francie. "I called for you this time, and it's your turn to call for me next time."
"I won't forget," promised Francie. There was company in the front room when Francie got home. Aunt Evie was there with her husband, Willie Flitman. Francie liked Aunt Evie. She looked a lot like Mama. She was full of fun and said things to make you laugh like people did in a show, and she could mimic anybody in the world. Uncle Flitman had brought his guitar along. He was playing it, and all were singing. Flitman was a thin, dark man with smooth black hair and a silky mustache. He played the guitar pretty well, considering that the middle finger of his right hand wasn't there. When he came to where he was supposed to use that finger, he'd give the guitar a thumping whack to do for the time when the note should be played. This gave a queer rhythm to his songs. He had nearly reached the end of his repertoire when Francie came in. She was just in time to hear his last selection. After the music, he went out and got a pitcher of beer. Aunt Evie treated to a loaf of pumpernickel bread and a dime's worth of Limburger cheese, and they had sandwiches and beer. Uncle Flitman got confidential after the beer. "Look on me, Kate," he said to Mama. "And you look on a man that's a failure." Aunt Evie rolled her eyes up and sighed, pulling in her lower lip. "My children don't respect me," he said. "My wife has no use for me. And Drummer, my milk wagon horse, has got it in for me. Do you know what he did to me just the other day?" He leaned forward, and Francie saw his eyes brighten with unshed tears. "I was washing him in the stable, and I was washing under his belly, and he went and wet on me." Katie and Evie looked at each other. Their eyes were dancing with hidden laughter. Katie looked suddenly at Francie. The laughter was still in her eyes, but her mouth was stern. Francie looked down on the floor and frowned, although she was laughing inside. "That's what he did, and all the men in the stable laughed at me. Everyone laughs at me." He drank another glass of beer.
"Don't talk like that, Will," said his wife.
"Evie doesn't love me," he said to Mama.
"I love you, Will,"
Evie assured him in her soft, tender voice that it was a caress in itself.
"You loved me when you married me, but you don't love me now, do you?"
He waited. Evie said nothing.
"You see, she don't love me anymore,"
he said to Mama.
"It's time we went home," said Evie.
Before they went to bed, Francie and Neely had to read a page of the Bible and a page from Shakespeare. That was a rule. Mama used to read the 2 pages to them each night until they were old enough to read for themselves. To save time, Neely read the Bible page and Francie read from Shakespeare. They had been at this reading for 6 years and were halfway through the Bible and up to Macbeth and Shakespeare's complete works. They raced through the reading, and by 11, all the Nolans, excepting Johnny, who was working, were in bed. On Saturday nights, Francie was allowed to sleep in the front room. She made a bed by pushing 2 chairs together in front of the window, where she could watch the people on the street. Lying there, she was aware of the nighttime noises in the house. People came in and went to their flats. Some were tired and dragged their feet. Others ran up the stairs lightly. One stumbled, cursing the torn linoleum in the hall. A baby cried half-heartedly, and a drunken man in one of the downstairs flats synopsized the wicked life he claimed his wife had led. At 2 in the morning, Francie heard Papa singing softly as he came up the stairs.
"Sweet Molly Malone, she drove her wheelbarrow through streets wide and narrow, crying."
Mama had the door open on crying. It was a game Papa had. If they got the door opened before he finished the verse, they won. If he was able to finish it out in the hall, he won. Francie and Neely got out of bed, and they all sat around the table and ate after Papa had put $3 down on the table and given the children each a nickel, which Mama made them put in the tin can bank, explaining they had already received money that day from the junk. Papa had brought home a paper bag full of food not used at the wedding because some of the guests hadn't come. The bride had divided the unconsumed food among the waiters. There was half of a cold broiled lobster, 5 stone-cold fried oysters, an inch jar of caviar, and a wedge of Roquefort cheese. The children didn't like the lobster, and the cold oysters had no taste, and the caviar seemed too salty. But they were so hungry that they ate everything on the table, and digested it, too, during the night. They could have digested nails had they been able to chew them.
After she had eaten, Francie at last faced the fact that she had broken the fast, which started at midnight, and was to have lasted until after Mass next morning. Now she could not receive communion. Here was a real sin to confess to the priest next week. Neely went back to bed and resumed his sound sleep. Francie went into the dark front room and sat by the window. She didn't feel like sleeping. Mama and Papa sat in the kitchen. They would sit there and talk until daybreak. Papa was telling about the night's work, the people he had seen, what they had looked like, and how they spoke. The Nolans just couldn't get enough of life. They lived their own lives up to the hilt, but that wasn't enough. They had to fill in on the lives of all the people they made contact with. So Johnny and Katie talked away the night, and the rise and fall of their voices was a safe and soothing sound in the dark. Now it was 3 in the morning, and the street was very quiet. Francie saw a girl who lived in a flat across the street come home from a dance with her feller. They stood pressed close together in her vestibule. They stood embracing without talking until the girl leaned back and unknowingly pressed the bells. Then her father came down in his long underdrawers and, with quiet but intense profanity, told the fellow what he could go and do to himself. The girl ran upstairs giggling hysterically while the boyfriend walked away down the street whistling, "When I Get You Alone Tonight." Mr. Tominey, who owned the pawn shop, came home in a hansom cab from his spendthrift evening in New York. He had never set foot inside his pawn shop, which he had inherited along with an efficient manager. No one knew why Mr. Tominey lived in the rooms above the shop, a man with his money. He lived the life of an aristocratic New Yorker in the squalor of Williamsburg. A plasterer who had been in his rooms reported them furnished with statues, oil paintings, and white fur rugs. Mr. Tominey was a bachelor. No one saw him all week. No one saw him leave Saturday evenings. Only Francie and the cop on the beat saw him come home. Francie watched him, feeling like a spectator in a theater box. His high silk hat was tipped over an ear. The streetlight picked up the gleam of his silver-knobbed cane as he tucked it under his arm. He swung back his white satin Inverness cape to get some money. The driver took the bill, touched the butt of his whip to the rim of his plug hat, and shook the horse's reins. Mr. Tominey watched him drive away as though the cab were the last link in a life that he had found good. Then he went upstairs to his fabulous apartment. He was supposed to frequent such legendary places as Reisenweber's and the Waldorf. Francie decided to see these places someday. Someday she would go across Williamsburg Bridge, which was only a few blocks away, and find her way uptown in New York, to where these fine places were and take a good look at the outside. Then she'd be able to place Mr. Tominey more accurately. A fresh breeze blew in over Brooklyn from the sea. From far away on the north side where the Italians lived and kept chickens in their yards came the crowing of a rooster. It was answered by the distant barking of a dog, and an inquiring whinny from the horse, Bob, comfortably bedded in his stable. Francie was glad for Saturday and hated to end it by going to sleep. Already the dread of the week to come made her uneasy. She fixed the memory of this Saturday in her mind. It was without fault, except for the old man waiting for bread. Other nights in the week she would have to lie on her cot, and from the air shaft hear the indistinct voices of the childlike bride who lived in one of the other flats with her ape-like truck-driver husband. The bride's voice would be soft and pleading, his rough and demanding. Then there would be a short silence. Then he would start snoring, and the wife would cry piteously until nearly morning. Recalling the sobs, Francie trembled and instinctively her hands flew to cover her ears. Then she remembered it was Saturday. She was in the front room where she couldn't hear sounds from the air shaft. Yes, it was still Saturday, and it was wonderful. Monday was a long time away. Peaceful Sunday would come in between, when she would think long thoughts about the nasturtiums in the brown bowl and the way the horse had looked being washed while standing in sunshine and shadow. She was growing drowsy. She listened a moment to Katie and Johnny talking in the kitchen. They were reminiscing. "I was 17 when I first met you," Katie was saying, "and I was working in the Castle Braid factory."
"I was 19 then," recalled Johnny, "and keeping company with your best friend, Hildy O'Dare."
"Oh, her," sniffed Katie. The sweet-smelling warm wind moved gently in Francie's hair. She folded her arms on the windowsill and laid her cheek on them. She could look up and see the stars high above the tenement roofs. After a while, she went to sleep. Book 2. It was in another Brooklyn summer, but 12 years earlier, in 1900, that Johnny Nolan first met Katie Romilly. He was 19, and she was 17. Katie worked in the Castle Braid factory. So did Hildy O'Dare, her best friend. They got along well, although Hildy was Irish, and Katie came from parents who had been born in Austria. Katie was prettier, but Hildy was bolder. Hildy had brassy blonde hair, wore a garnet-colored chiffon bow around her neck, chewed sen-sen, knew all the latest songs, and was a good dancer. Hildy had a feller, a beau who took her dancing Saturday nights. His name was Johnny Nolan. Sometimes he waited for Hildy outside the factory. He always brought some of the boys along to wait with him. They stood loafing on the corner, telling jokes and laughing. One day, Hildy asked Johnny to bring someone for Katie, her girlfriend, the next time they went dancing. Johnny obliged. The four of them rode out to Canarsie on the trolley. The boys wore straw Katies, with a cord attached to the brim and the other end to their coat lapel. The stiff ocean breeze blew the hats off, and there was much laughter when the boys pulled the skimmers back by the cords. Johnny danced with his girl, Hildy. Katie refused to dance with the feller provided for her, a vacuous, vulgar boy given to remarks like, "I thought you must have fallen in," when Katie returned from a trip to the ladies' room. However, she let him buy her a beer, and she sat at the table watching Johnny dancing with Hildy, and thinking that in all the world, there was nobody like Johnny. Johnny's feet were long and slender, and his shoes were shiny. He danced with his toes pointed in, and rocked from heel to toe with beautiful rhythm. It was hot, dancing. Johnny hung his coat over the back of his chair. His trousers settled well on his hips, and his white shirt bloused over his belt. He wore a high, stiff collar and a polka-dotted tie, which matched the band on his straw hat. Baby blue sleeve garters of satin ribbon, shirred onto elastic, which Katie jealously suspected Hildy had made for him. So jealous was she that for the rest of her life she hated that color. Katie couldn't stop looking at him. He was young, slender, and shining, with blonde curly hair and deep blue eyes. His nose was straight and his shoulders broad and square. She heard the girls at the next table say that he was a nifty dresser. Their escort said he was a nifty dancer, too. Although he did not belong to her, Katie was proud of him. Johnny gave her a courtesy dance when the orchestra played Sweet Rosie O'Grady. Feeling his arms around her and instinctively adjusting herself to his rhythm, Katie knew that he was the man she wanted. She'd ask nothing more than to look at him and to listen to him for the rest of her life. Then and there, she decided that those privileges were worth slaving for all her life. Maybe that decision was her great mistake. She should have waited until some man came along who felt that way about her. Then her children would not have gone hungry, she would not have had to scrub floors for their living, and her memory of him would have remained a tender, shining thing. But she wanted Johnny Nolan and no one else, and she set out to get him. Her campaign started the following Monday. When the whistle blew dismissal, she ran out of the factory, reached the corner before Hildy did, and sang out, "Hello, Johnny Nolan." "Hello, Katie, dear," he answered. After that, she'd managed to get a few words with him each day. Johnny found that he was waiting around on the corner for those few words. One day Katie, falling back on a woman's always respected excuse, told her forelady that it was the time of the month. She didn't feel so good. She got out 15 minutes before closing time. Johnny was waiting on the corner with his friends. They were whistling Annie Rooney to pass the time away. Johnny cocked his skimmer over one eye, put his hands in his pockets, and did a waltz clog there on the sidewalk. Passers-by stopped to admire. The cop, walking his beat, called out, "You're losing time, sport. You ought to be on the stage." Johnny saw Katie coming along and stopped performing and grinned at her. She looked mighty fetching in a tight-fitting gray suit, trimmed with black braid from the factory. Intricately whorled and squirreled, the braid trimming was designed to call attention to her modest bust, already helped out by two rows of ruffles pinned to her corset cover. With the gray suit, she wore a cherry-colored tam pulled over one eye, and Visi-Kid high-button shoes with spool heels. Her brown eyes sparkled, and her cheeks glowed with excitement and shame as she thought how fresh she must look, running after a feller like that. Johnny hailed her. The other boys drifted away. What Katie and Johnny said to each other on that special day, they never remembered. Somehow, during their aimless but oh-so-significant conversation, with its delicious pauses and thrilling undercurrents of emotion, they came to know that they loved each other passionately. The factory whistle blew and the girls streamed out of the castle braid. Hildy came along in a mud-colored brown suit, and a black sailor skewered onto her ratted, brassy pompadour with an evil-looking hatpin. She smiled possessively when she saw Johnny, but the smile changed to a spasm of hurt, fear, and then hate when she saw Katie with him. She rushed down on them, pulling her long hatpin from her sailor.
"He's my fella, Katie Romilly," she screamed, "and you can't steal him away."
"Hildy, Hildy," said Johnny in his soft, unhurried voice.
"I guess this is a free country," said Katie, tossing her head.
"Not free for robbers,"
yelled Hildy as she lunged at Katie with her hatpin. Johnny stepped between the girls and got the scratch down his cheek. By this time, a crowd of Castlebrake girls had gathered and were watching them with delighted cluckings. Johnny took each girl by the arm and steered them around the corner. He crowded them into a doorway and imprisoned them there with his arm while he talked to them.
"Hildy," he said, "I'm not much good. I shouldn't have led you on because I see now that I can't marry you."
"It's all her fault,"
wept Hildy.
"Mine," acknowledged Johnny handsomely. "I never knew what true love was till I met Katie."
"But she's my best friend,"
said Hildy piteously, as though Johnny were committing a kind of incest.
"She's my best girl now, and there's nothing more to say about it."
Hildy wept and argued. Finally, Johnny quieted her down and explained how it was with him and Katie. He ended by saying that Hildy was to go her way and he'd go his. He liked the sound of his words. He repeated them again, enjoying the drama of the moment.
"So you go your way, and I'll go mine."
"You mean, I go my way, and you go her way," said Hildy bitterly.
Finally, Hildy went her way. She walked down the street with her shoulders sagging. Johnny ran after her, and there on the street he put his arms about her and kissed her tenderly in farewell.
"I wish it could have been different with us," he said sadly.
"You wish no such thing," snapped Hildy. "If you did,"
she started crying again,
"you'd just give her the gate and start going out with me again."
Katie was crying too. After all, Hildy O'Dare had been her best friend. She too kissed Hildy. She looked away when she saw Hildy's tear-wetted eyes so close to hers grow small with hate. So Hildy went her way, and Johnny went Katie's way. They kept company for a little while, became engaged, and were married in Katie's church on New Year's Day, 1901. They had known each other not quite 4 months when they married. Thomas Romilly never forgave his daughter. In fact, he never forgave any of his daughters for marrying. His philosophy about children was simple and profitable. A man enjoyed himself begetting them, put in as little money and effort into their upbringing as was possible, and then put them to work earning money for the father as soon as they got into their teens. Katie, at 17, had only been working 4 years when she married. He figured that she owed him money. Romilly hated everybody and everything. No one ever found out why. He was a massive, handsome man with iron-gray curly hair covering a leonine head. He had run away from Austria with his bride to avoid being conscripted into the army. Although he hated the old country, he stubbornly refused to like the new country. He understood and could speak English if he wanted to, but he refused to answer when addressed in English and forbade the speaking of English in his home. His daughters understood very little German. Their mother insisted that the girls speak only English in the home. She reasoned that the less they understood German, the less they would find out about the cruelty of their father. Consequently, the four daughters grew up having little communion with their father. He never spoke to them except to curse them. His Gott verdammte came to be regarded as hello and goodbye. When very angry, he called the object of his temper Durusa. This he considered his most obscene expletive. He hated Austria. He hated America. Most of all, he hated Russia. He had never been to that country and had never laid eyes on a Russian. No one understood his hatred of that dimly known country and its vaguely known people. This was the man who was Francie's maternal grandfather. She hated him the way his daughters hated him. Mary Romilly, his wife and Francie's grandmother, was a saint.
She had no education. She could not read or write her own name. But she had in her memory over 1,000 stories and legends. Some she had invented to entertain her children. Others were old folk tales told to her by her own mother and her grandmother. She knew many old country songs and understood all the wise sayings. She was intensely religious and knew the life story of every Catholic saint. She believed in ghosts and fairies and all supernatural folk. She knew all about herbs and could brew you either a medicine or a charm, provided you intended no evil with the charm. Back in the old country, she had been honored for her wisdom and much sought out for her advice. She was a blameless, sinless woman, yet she understood how it was with people who sinned. Inflexibly rigid in her own moral conduct, she condoned weaknesses in others. She revered God and loved Jesus, but she understood why people often turned away from these two. She had been a virgin when she married, and had humbly submitted to her husband's brutal love. His brutality early killed all of her latent desires. Yet she could understand the fierce love hunger that made girls, as people put it, go wrong. She understood how a boy who had been driven from the neighborhood for rape could still be a good boy at heart. She understood why people had to lie and steal and harm one another. She knew of all pitiful human weaknesses and of many cruel strengths. Yet she could not read or write. Her eyes were soft brown, limpid, and innocent. She wore her shining brown hair parted in the middle and drawn down over her ears. Her skin was pale and translucent, and her mouth was tender. She spoke in a low, soft, warmly melodious voice that soothed those who listened. All of her daughters and granddaughters inherited this quality of voice from her. Mary was convinced that because of some sin she had unwittingly committed in her life, she was mated with the devil himself. She really believed this because her husband told her so. "I am the devil himself," he told her frequently. She often looked at him, the way two locks of his hair stood up on either side of his head, the way his cold gray eyes slanted upward at the outer corners, and she sighed and said to herself, "Yes, he is the devil." He had a way of looking full into her saintly face, and in a falsely caressing tone he would accuse Christ of unspeakable things. This always terrified her so much that she'd take her shawl from the nail behind the door, throw it over her head, and rush forth into the street where she would walk and walk until concern for her children drove her back into the house. She went to the public school that the three youngest girls attended, and in halting English told the teacher that the children must be encouraged to speak only English, that they were not to use a German word or phrase ever. In that way she protected them against their father. She grieved when her children had to leave school after the sixth grade and go out working. She grieved when they married no-account men. She wept when they gave birth to daughters, knowing that to be born a woman meant a life of humble hardship. Each time Francie began the prayer, "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee," her grandmother's face came before her. Sissy was the oldest child of Thomas and Mary Romilly. She had been born 3 months after her parents landed in America. She had never gone to school. At the time when she should have started, Mary did not understand that free education was available for people like them. There were laws about sending children to school, but no one sought out these ignorant people in order to enforce the law. By the time the other girls reached school age, Mary had learned about free education, but Sissy was then too big to start in with the six-year-olds. She stayed home and helped her mother. At 10, Sissy was as fully developed as a woman of 30, and all the boys were after Sissy, and Sissy was after all the boys. At 12, she started keeping steady company with a lad of 20. Her father nipped that romance by beating up the boy. At 14, she was going with a fireman of 25. Because he licked her father instead of the other way around, this romance ended in the fireman marrying Sissy. They went to City Hall, where Sissy swore that she was 18 and were married by one of the clerks. The neighbors were shocked, but Mary knew that marriage was the best thing that could happen to her highly sexed daughter. Jim, the fireman, was a good man. He was considered educated, having graduated from grammar school. He made good money and wasn't home much. He was an ideal husband. They were very happy. Sissy demanded little from him except a lot of lovemaking, which made him very happy. Sometimes he was a little ashamed because his wife couldn't read or write. But she was so witty and clever and warm-hearted that she made of living a high, joyous thing, and in time he began to overlook her illiteracy. Sissy was very good to her mother and her younger sisters. Jim gave her a fair household allowance. She was very careful with it, and usually had money left over to give her mother. She became pregnant a month after marriage. She was still a hoyden girl of 14 in spite of her womanly status.
The neighbors were horrified when they watched her skipping rope on the street with other children, heedless of the yet-to-be-born baby who is now an almost unwieldy bulge. In the hours not devoted to cooking, cleaning, lovemaking, rope-skipping, and trying to get into the baseball game with the boys, Sissy made plans for the coming baby. If it were a girl, she was going to call it Mary after her mother. If a boy, it would be named John. For some unknown reason, she had a great affection for the name John. She began calling Jim by the name of John. She said she wanted to name him after the baby. At first it was an affectionate nickname, but soon everyone got to calling him John, and many people believed that that was his real name. The baby was born. It was a girl, and a very easy birth. The midwife down the block was called in. Everything went fine. Sissy was in labor only 25 minutes. It was a wonderful delivery. The only thing wrong with the whole business was that the baby was born dead. Coincidentally, the baby was born and died on Sissy's 15th birthday. She grieved a while, and her grief changed her. She worked harder at keeping her house spotless and clean. She became even more thoughtful of her mother. She stopped being a tomboy. She was convinced that the rope skipping had cost her the child. As she quieted down, she seemed younger and more childlike. By the time she was 20, she had had 4 children, all born dead. Finally, she came to the conclusion that her husband was at fault. It wasn't her fault. Hadn't she stopped skipping rope after the first child? She told Jim that she didn't care for him anymore, since nothing but death grew out of their lovemaking. She told him to leave her. He argued a little, but went finally. At first he sent her money from time to time. Sometimes, when Sissy got lonesome for a man, she'd walk past the firehouse where Jim would be sitting outside with his chair tilted against the brick wall. She'd walk slow, smiling and swaying her hips, and Jim would take unauthorized leave, run up to the flat, and they'd be very happy together for a half hour or so. Eventually, Sissy met another man who wanted to marry her. What his real name was, nobody in her family knew, because she began calling him John right away. Her second marriage was arranged very simply. Divorce was complicated and expensive. Besides, she was a Catholic and didn't believe in divorce. She and Jim had been married by a clerk in City Hall. She reasoned that it hadn't been a church or a real marriage, so why let it stand in her way? Using her marriage name and saying nothing about her previous marriage, she was married again in City Hall, but by a different clerk. Mary, her mother, was distressed because Sissy hadn't married in the church. The second marriage provided Thomas with a new implement of torture for his wife. He often told her that he was going to tell a policeman and have Sissy arrested for bigamy. But before he could get around to it, Sissy and her second John had been married 4 years. She had given birth to 4 more children, all born dead, and she had decided that this second John wasn't her man either. She dissolved the marriage very simply by telling her husband, a Protestant, that since the Catholic Church didn't recognize her marriage, she didn't recognize it either, and she now announced her freedom. John, too, took it in his stride. He liked Sissy and had been fairly happy with her, but she was like Quicksilver. In spite of her terrifying frankness and overwhelming naivete, he really knew nothing about her, and he was tired of living with an enigma. He didn't feel too bad about going away. Sissy, at 24, had borne 8 children, none of whom had lived. She decided that God was against her marrying. She got a job in a rubber factory, where she told everyone she was an old maid, which no one believed, and went home to live with her mother. Between her second and third marriage, she had a succession of lovers, all of whom she called John. After each futile birth, her love of children grew stronger. She had dark moods in which she thought she would go crazy if she didn't have a child to love. She poured out her frustrated maternity on the men she slept with, on her 2 sisters, Evie and Katie, and on their children. Francie adored her. She had heard it whispered that Sissy was a bad girl, but she loved her fiercely just the same. Evie and Katie tried to be mad at their erring sister, but she was so good to them that they couldn't hold out against her. Soon after Francie was 11, Sissy married for the 3rd time at City Hall. The third John was the one who worked in the magazine company, and through him Francie had those fine new magazines each month. She hoped the third marriage would endure because of the magazines. Eliza, the second daughter of Mary and Thomas, lacked the prettiness and fire of her 3 sisters. She was plain and dull and indifferent to life. Mary, wanting to give one of her daughters to the church, decided that Eliza was the one. Eliza entered a convent at 16. She chose a very rigid order of nuns. She was never permitted to leave the convent walls except on the occasion of her parents' death. She took the name of Ursula, and a sister Ursula, she became an unreal legend to Francie. Francie saw her once when she came out of the convent to attend Thomas Romilly's funeral. Francie was 9 at the time. She had just made her first communion and had given herself so wholeheartedly to the church that she thought she might like to be a nun when she grew up. She awaited Sister Ursula's coming with excitement. Just think of it, an aunt who was a nun. What an honor. But when Sister Ursula stooped to kiss her, Francie saw that she had a fine fringe of hair on her upper lip and chin. This frightened Francie into believing that hair grew on the faces of all nuns who entered the convent at a tender age. Francie decided against sisterhood. Evie was the third Romilly girl. She, too, had married young. She married Willie Flipman, a handsome black-haired man with a silky mustache and liquid eyes like an Italian. Francie thought that he had a very comical name, and she laughed to herself every time she thought of it. Flipman wasn't much good. He wasn't exactly a bum. He was just a weak man who whined all the time. But he played the guitar. Those Romilly women had a weakness for any kind of man who was by way of being a creator or a performer. Any kind of musical, artistic, or storytelling talent was wonderful to them, and they felt it their duty to nurture and guard these things. Evie was the refined one of the family. She lived in a cheap basement flat on the fringes of a very refined neighborhood and studied her betters. She wanted to be somebody, wanted her children to have advantages she had never had. She had 3 children, a boy named after his father, a girl named Blossom, and another boy called Paul Jones. Her first step towards refinement was to take her children out of the Catholic Sunday school and put them in the Episcopal Sunday school. She had gotten it into her head that the Protestants were more refined than the Catholics. Evie, loving talent in music and lacking it herself, sought for it avidly in her children. She hoped that Blossom would like to sing and that Paul Jones would want to play the fiddle and little Willie the piano. But there was no music in the children. Evie took the bull by the horns. They would have to love music whether they wanted to or not. If talent wasn't born in them, maybe it could be shoved in at so much per hour. She bought a second-hand fiddle for Paul Jones and negotiated lessons for him at 50 cents an hour from a man who called himself Professor Allegretto. He taught little Flipman fearsome scrapings and at the end of the year gave him the piece called Humoresque. Evie thought it was wonderful when he got a piece to play. It was better than playing the scales all the time. Well, a little better. Then Evie got more ambitious. Being, she said to her husband, that we've got the fiddle for Paul Jones, little Blossom could take lessons too, and both could practice on the same fiddle.
At different times, I hope, replied her husband sourly.
What do you think? She answered indignantly. So 50 cents more a week was scraped up and folded into Blossom's reluctant hand, and she was sent off to take fiddle lessons too. It so happened that Professor Allegretto had a very slight peculiarity concerning his girl pupils. He made them take off their shoes and stockings and stand in their bare feet on his green carpet while they sawed away. Instead of beating time or correcting their fingering, he spent the hour in a reverie staring at their feet. Evie was watching Blossom getting ready for a lesson one day. She noticed that the child removed her shoes and stockings and washed her feet carefully. Evie thought that commendable, but a little strange.
And why do you wash your feet now?
For my fiddle lessons.
You play with your hands, not your feet.
I feel ashamed standing in front of the professor with dirty feet.
He can see through your shoes, maybe?
I don't think so, because he always makes me take my shoes and stockings off.
This made Evie jump. She knew nothing of Freud, and her scanty knowledge of sex did not include any of its deviations. But her common sense told her that Professor Allegretto should not charge 50 cents an hour and not attend to his work. Blossom's musical education was terminated then and there. Upon being questioned, Paul Jones said that he had never been asked to take anything off but his hat when he went for a lesson. He was allowed to continue. In 5 years, he could play the fiddle almost as well as his father, who had never taken a lesson in his life, could play the guitar. Aside from his music, Uncle Flipman was a dull man. At home, his only topic of conversation was the way Drummer, the milk wagon horse, treated him. Flipman and the horse had been feuding for 5 years, and Evie hoped that one of them would get the decision soon. Evie really loved her husband, although she could not resist mimicking him. She'd stand in the Nolan kitchen and pretend that she was the horse, Drummer, and she'd give a good imitation of Uncle Flipman trying to put the feed bag on the horse.
The horse is standing at the curb like this. Evie leaned over until her head was dangling at her knees.
Will comes along with the feed bag. He's just about to put it on, when up goes the horse's head.
Here Evie would jerk her head high and whinny like a horse. Will waits. The horse's head goes down again. You'd think he never could get it up in the air. The horse makes out like he's got no bones. Evie's head lolled alarmingly. Comes Will with the feedback. Up goes the head.
Then what happens? Asked Francie.
I go down and put the feedback on the horse. That's what happens.
Does he let you?
Does he let me? Evie reported to Katie, then turned to Francie.
Why, he runs up on the sidewalk to meet me and sticks his head in the feedback before I can lift it up even.
Does he let me? She murmured indignantly.